more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting, confusing, challenging, and
other ing words.
Boring.
Well, we try not to be.
Salivating. But, you know. Episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Okay.
That's it.
Now I always forget what I'm supposed to say.
No.
As a matter of disclosure, The Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. It also is the name of a SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, called, coincidentally, or not coincidentally, The Personal Wealth Coach, where
Wow.
we do wealth management for people by managing portfolios. So we've been doing this quite a while. I am the more senior of the two of us. I'm Jeff, and this guy sitting over here next to me is Jake. And boy, are we weird today.
You're wearing plaid, and I'm wearing stripes.
We're going to be very confused today.
Yeah. Nobody's going to be able to tell us apart.
I don't know if they can tell us. I can't tell us apart most of the time.
Well, he has a white beard, and I have more of a black beard with some gray tinges.
And his secret name is William Teach.
Not that black beard.
Well, you...
I'm not piratical at all.
You're not?
No.
He was just an entrepreneur.
A capitalist in the robber baron sense without any of the capitalism, but a lot of the robber. Yes.
I know. He accumulated capital, I think.
Yes, he did.
And he invested it and did all kinds of things.
He put it in the ground. He banked it very well.
Put it in banks, literally, right?
Stream banks, river banks, yes, islands, yeah.
Yeah, and he definitely was a no-nonsense sort of manager.
That's true, yeah. If you disobeyed him, he would just leave you on an island and come back in a year.
Let's see, it was 16 men.
On an island
on Dead Man's Chest.
It's called Dead Chest, yeah. I've been there. It's you've been there.
And he left them. But he, you know, he was very...
A bottle of rum and a cutlass.
Yes.
One.
And what, this one of them was alive when he
came back? Yeah, when he came back, there was one left, and that man became his first mate. A year later. Yeah, I mean...
So...
I don't think he's going to disobey again anytime soon. That's...
No, probably not. Anyway, if you'd like to call and ask... I started to say, I've been at this... 31 years plus. Wow. So
I've only been doing it for 23.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm see, we could say like we were like, you know, 44 years between us. Well,
54 years.
54
we
years.
We could, yeah, 54 years of collective experience.
We just
need to have a
I don't
large
think collective.
Staff.
I think it would be cumulative.
Cumulative. We just need a large staff. We need about 300 people that have all been there for a 1 year.
We could say 300 years of collective experience.
Right, and people would go, oh, that sounds so impressive. And we'd go, not really, we're all new.
Anyway, telephone number's in here if you'd like to call and take advantage of the many, many, many mistakes we have made so we can tell you how not to make the same mistakes we made. You can make new and interesting mistakes instead.
Oh, so much fun for later radio programs.
Yes.
We can say how not to do those mistakes.
You can give us a call in here at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
So, what happened this week?
Well, your voice became a little bit snotty and congested. That happened this week.
Yeah. I am suffering from a viral infection in my lungs, which is not particularly pleasant, but probability is I will live through it.
That's high probability, yes.
And not sleeping very much, but I'm getting a lot of things done.
So what happened this week? Well, let's see.
On Friday, something happened.
Yeah, on Friday, a lot of things happened.
Record-breaking event. We've become so used to these record-breaking events.
A gorilla went through the China shop. Broke a lot of records.
That might get the job done.
No, that's not the record-breaking event you were talking about. What were you talking about?
Dow closes at record high.
It's barely even noticed.
Yeah, that's That's one of the things that makes me just a little bit nervous is when we no longer even bother to notice that the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at a record high. It's at 1,878.48.
What? No.
No, that's the S&P 500.
I was going to say, that's
no,
a record.
16,580.84.
Right. Well, the headline does all over the place, does say Dow breaks record. I just ignore headlines most of the time. So there.
Well, this is the reason I got those mixed up is because I've been doing this a long time.
And you do remember when the Dow was at 1,800 something or another.
Yeah, I actually remember when it was at 800 something or another, and I remember when it went through 1,000.
Yeah, I was working with you when it went through 3,000.
Well, it dropped down to 1,350 in 1987 at the bottom, and the fact that it is 16,005, roughly 581 at the close on Friday. Had I told somebody 16,583.34. Well, we have different numbers here.
Oh.
Yeah, it does. It says 16,583.34 there.
I guess the record closed before was 81,581.
That's the one I'm looking
Aha.
at.
Aha. So we beat it by 2 points.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is 16,583. Had I suggested, 15 years ago.
That it was ever going to be this high.
As a matter of fact, I wrote in a newsletter at some point, I don't remember, I'd have to go back and look, that the Dow will get to 16,000. And I also wrote that it would get to 32,000. And I got a lot of people who told me I was obviously using illegal or controlled substances. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes. You were talking about the Dow Jones and how it's much different than it was in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Is there a... I mean, because companies come and go. They get dropped off and they get added to the Dow Jones, correct?
And there's very few of them left from the 1980s, I promise you.
Right.
And then that's what I'd be curious about. I mean, if you pick the Dow Jones at a companies that were in it in the 80s, what would the Dow Jones look like in a comparison today?
I think there's only one left, isn't there? Maybe two?
There's more than that. I think there's... I don't know. I would have to look.
There's not very many left from the 1980s.
It's actually where you're going with this question is a really good one. First, we have to say, what is the Dow? And while we use it to compare, you know, there's 30 companies in it right now. There's always 30 companies in it.
Well, at one time there was 10.
Well, that wasn't the industrial average.
Well,
the industrial average.
It was just the Dow Jones average.
Right. And that became the Dow Jones transportation average. But basically what an index is, it's designed to measure the overall market. And the editors of the Wall Street Journal are the ones that put together this index. And they do it based on the overall market. Well, one of the problems with indexes that has arisen in the last 15 years or so is people try to use them to invest with, to invest in the index. Well, what you're investing in an index is not going to do as well as the index. Because, as we were just saying, in the 1980s, there were a lot of companies that were in the Dow then that are not in the Dow now, because they failed. And if you had just said, well, the Dow Jones does well, I'm going to buy all the companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and I should be able to do well into the future, you wouldn't have a whole lot of money left. You wouldn't do very well at all doing that. So long term, the index is not intended to be something you invest in. And we talk about this with the S&P 500. There's 500 companies in that one. And again, you look at the S&P 500 and you say, well, it does fairly well over a long period of time. But if you look at the 500 companies that are in it in the S&P 500, you don't have the same kind of failure rate in the S&P 500 as far as percentage goes. But when a company is pulled out of the index, whether it's the Dow or the S&P, it doesn't affect the index. They replace it with another company immediately, and it looks like nothing happened. When we do individual investing, when people, you and I and cousins and people that you see on the street invest, if they're doing it based on trying to match an index, if it's an index fund, and this is something we have talked about for years on the program. In fact, way back when we were, when index investing was first coming out and I was first joining the program, I used to say something that would cause the phone lines to all light up. When we'd have a slow day, I would say, index investing is communist. And, of course, everybody would try calling in at once to explain how they've got indexes in their portfolio and they're not communist and so on. Well, if you look at the S&P 500 and the index funds that are made to try to track those that index, the S&P 500 is what's called capitally weighted, which means that the larger the company is, the more impact it has on the index, which is a good idea. Walmart should have a larger effect on the index than the smallest of the companies in the S&P 500. If Walmart tanks, then the S&P 500 is going to have movement. If the smallest company on the index tanks, it shouldn't. However, if you're trying to buy the companies in the index in the same way that the index does, then you're buying more of the big companies and less of the little companies. And you're not doing it based on if they're profitable or if they are unprofitable, if they have good management or if they're going around in circles looking for nothing. So if you look at Marxism, it's from each according to merit, to each according to need. And it looks like what we would be doing if we invested in the index is sending more money to large companies and less money to small companies, regardless of their management, not rewarding anybody for good management or punishing for bad management. So the concepts of indexes comes back to, it's a media event. The editors of the Wall Street Journal pick the stocks that are in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Standard & Poor's company, which is a magazine company, picks the companies that are in the S&P 500. And they do it so that they can give us a headline, which was what we started the program with. We said, you know, there's a record. Well, a record what? The index, the Dow Jones Industrial Average that we're celebrating this great record for, started with an arbitrary number. It was just a number picked out of the sky, out of people's heads, just number 10. There you go. We'll start with that, and then we'll average movement from there. So when we break a record that started with an imaginary number, it's still an imaginary number, but now we've all agreed that it's a record of an imaginary number.
And there's another thing that is probably worth bearing in mind whenever you look at performance or read articles on performance in the market. And that is that the indexes or indices cheat.
Yes.
In several different ways.
Lots of different ways, actually.
For example, the question that the caller raised is very, very good. I've got a list of the most recent update to the Dow Jones Industrial Average, September 20th, 2013, and another one from June 29th, 1979, which was closest to 1980. There's not a lot of parallel in there. The concept of buy and hold, excuse me, an index indicates you're buying and holding a single investment. Well, the reality is, for example, in 1979, had you bought the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which if you bought all the stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you'd have had to do some pretty substantial trading. 53 times it's changed its components. And some of the things that were in it in 1979, like American Tobacco, Bethlehem Steel, Eastman Kodak, you start down the list of some of the things that were in it in 1979, and you realize these companies, Sears Roebuck, for example, Sears has been through bankruptcy since then.
And was purchased by Kmart.
Yes. So the point is, Union Carbide, which just kind of vanished.
Disappeared
beneath the waves,
in a cyanide explosion.
U.S. Steel. Westinghouse was in Westinghouse doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it exists as a name.
Yeah, but as a company, it doesn't exist.
Correct.
So the issue that if you compare, for example, ignore several really interesting things. One of the things is they ignore that there's trading costs. They ignore that
this
there
is the
are...
index. Ignores the index. Trading costs.
And they do, whenever a company does poorly, they simply replace it with a company that's done well.
That's called succession bias.
And that is really a pretty impressive way, if I could run a portfolio that way, so that I would always have only top producers in my portfolio, that would work really well. Now, there's a second factor that I like to point out, and that is when a company is added to the S&P 500 stock index, and that happens fairly frequently, the price will jump at the opening of the next market.
Of that company stock, yes.
It will jump substantially.
Because people buy it simply because it's in the index.
That, and there's so many index funds out there that have to buy it because it's in the index.
Right.
So even though, and I do think the indexes are a good measure of where the market is, but it's really important to remember that they're inflated. If you compare them with a real investment, an index is inflated. It's inflated because of indexing. That's what Jake was talking about earlier. Because of indexing, and because there's so much money in index, particularly S&P 500 index funds, it tends to pump those shares that are actually listed in the S&P 500 index to higher levels just because they're there.
All right, this is a great example, and this is one I use as an analogy. I use the depth gauges on the pool, but you can use this is easier. Think of your rain gauge. It's just a vial that has marks on the side. Well, the index is supposed to be the marks on the side, not the water in it. It's just the marks. This is how high the water level is, how much rain that we've had. Oh, record amount of rain. The measurements are the index. It's measuring the water, but it isn't the water. When we start investing in an index, it would be like a coffee maker, if you're familiar with the older coffee makers, where you had the little vial on the side that shows how deep the water in the back reserve is. And it's there just to show how deep, it's just a little vial that shows how deep that whole back, it should be a whole pot's worth when you fill up the back area. Well, if instead of filling up the back area, you poured a whole pot into the vial, that vial is not going to be a very good measurement of what's in the reserve. So the more we invest in the index simply because it's the index, the less an accurate measurement of the reserve it is, the less a measurement is of the overall market. The NASDAQ is a different story. The NASDAQ is everything that's traded on a certain area. The New York Stock Exchange, if it were to report a number that says this is what's going on, first, it wouldn't get used very often because the news media is who does the reporting, and they already have their indexes that were made by them. So Bloomberg is famous for this. They will charge other news organizations to use the Bloomberg indexes. So if there's a headline that says Bloomberg, whatever index does this, there's a charge that shows up on... Anyway, that's an excellent question from the caller. And it's one where when we look at indexes, they're only supposed to be used as a measurement. This is something we can't... I realize that I'm saying that a lot, but it's very important. When we look at a individual person's portfolio, we will rarely say it's a good idea to be in an index position. And that's only if that's really the only choice, or if it's something like Ginnie Mae's, which the index is going to be as good as any manager anyway. Because Ginnie Mae's are Ginnie Mae's, and Ginnie Mae's are government national Morgan Association. They're just, it's like saying, what bank account is better, the one on that street corner or the one on that street corner? And you're probably talking about six of one and half a dozen of another.
Yep.
That's the only time when indexes would be appropriate, in my opinion.
And there are little disclosure, we do use indexes, and we manage in asset classes where there's, as he was saying, when we don't have a, we can't find any significant value in using managers because the indexes generally perform as well as the managers.
Now, when we're talking about, this is something that is fascinating.
But that's, yeah.
There's a study that has been put out by Dalbar since 1982 that measures the performance of the S&P 500 and then measures the performance of your average mutual fund that invests in the S&P 500.
Oh, yeah.
And it shows consistently that the average mutual fund, just the average, just the run-of-the-mill, beats the index as long as that manager or that mutual fund is investing only in those companies. And people go, well, that doesn't make sense. I have to tell you, well, take a look at it for a second. If you have a person that's saying, I'm going to put a whole bunch of stuff into a basket just because it's the right size, then you have rotten stuff in there as well as good stuff in there. And then you have another person that says, well, I'm going to only put the stuff in my basket that's not rotten, that's not obviously rotten. Well, it's no brainer. That should be a better basket to eat out of than the one that has the rotten stuff in it. And that's the way there's an old statistic that's quoted and quoted and quoted, which is that the S&P 500 beats the average mutual fund. And it's a true statistic. How's that for a twist on what I just said? Because I just told you that the average mutual fund beats the S&P, except it's not the average mutual fund that beats the S&P. It's the average mutual fund that invests in the S&P beats the S&P.
Well, there's a little more to it than that.
Right.
It gets very complicated. That's kind of the understatement of
The statistic that is quoted so often is measuring all mutual funds, whether they're bond funds. A money market fund is a mutual fund. And if you measure the performance of the S&P 500 against the average of all funds out there, of course it's going to beat it.
Actually, that was only true for a few years and is no longer true. In almost every time frame that you look at, because I looked at this just the other day, in almost every time frame that you look at right now, if you give all the mutual funds, first off, let's back up a step. Let's limit our comparison to large cap blend funds. Okay? That's because the S&P 500 is large cap stocks, and it's called a blend of growth and value. Okay, so the S&P 500 is a large cap blend mix. Okay,
right. So if you measured just large cap blends against the S&P 500.
I can go into Morningstar, and I can pick large cap blend funds and then limit it so that there's only one portfolio per fund showing. For whatever it's worth, folks, you may not know this, but there are some mutual fund portfolios out there that have 16 different names, literally 16 different names. They show up in 16 different companies. They show up with price differentials. I mean, the amount that's charged to get the management for that particular portfolio with that manager managing that portfolio are all over the screen. Anyway, so we got several hundred funds. And the S&P 500 always winds up in every time frame looking backwards below the 50th percentile. So if we measured the S&P 500 against mutual funds that invest in the same kind of stocks that you find in the S&P 500, lo and behold, the average mutual fund outperforms the S&P 500, which, by the way, makes sense. And I realize that the efficient market guys will get very upset at me for suggesting that you could actually find that managing something will give you a better performance than if you don't manage it. However, anybody that's been in business for any length of time realizes that if you don't have manager, that good managers will do better than no management. Unfortunately, there's an awful lot of folks out there who aren't good managers, but that's beside the point. But there's a more interesting thing. You're looking at something there. Is it? You got something?
Well, yeah, I was just sending a text saying congratulations. There's a friend of mine that is graduating with a bachelor's degree today. She went back to school. She is in her late 30s.
Well, good.
And
old folks going to school is a good thing.
Becoming a teacher. So I was sending a congratulations. That's a it's an amazing thing that's happening there. Anyway,
I know an old guy that's going to school too. Anyway, the in today's Wall Street Journal, at least I think it's today's. It was today online. Anyway, it was there May 9th. Okay, yesterday's. The Intelligent Investor by Jason Zweig, Z-W-E-I-G. I still don't know how to pronounce his name. He's talking about the newest Dalbar study that just came out. The average investor in all U.S. stock funds earned 3.7% annually, it's compounded, over the past 30 years, according to Dalbar. The S&P 500 stock index over that period earned 11.1% annually. I mean, is that, that never ceases to shock me when I read that.
So your average investor, just you and I, the people that wander around on the street, the average of those people gets a
3.7%.
So that's your long-term return. And they're investing in funds that are invested in the S&P 500.
Well, not necessarily. They're just investing.
Okay. So they're just investing. But the S&P 500
funds,
has done 11.1.
Right.
That's a significant difference. So what does that come from?
Well, the biggest factor is investor behavior.
They're getting out at the wrong time. They're getting in at the wrong time.
Yeah, and basically, they shouldn't be getting out or getting in. They should just invest. If they were just invest and stay there, they probably wouldn't have gotten the 11.1% return. Who knows? Because they probably wouldn't have been 100% in equity mutual
funds. But what we were just saying, if they were, if they had been 100% in that same mutual funds that what you were just saying, Morningstar's large blend, if they're invest, that's S&P 500, and it beats the S&P 500. The average of those beat the S&P 500.
So if they were in a large blend fund, and by the way, there's another little interesting tidbit if you happen to be as geeky as I am, and that is the larger the fund, the better the performance. I know that sounds crazy. It sounds backwards.
Depending on the area, but yes.
The point is that if you capital weight all funds, all these blend funds, all these large cap blend funds, the larger the fund gets outside of indexing, the better the return. Now, why is that true? Not because large funds get better returns, but because funds that consistently get better returns have more people investing in them and appreciate more. And the investors tend to stay with funds that have better returns. As a result, lo and behold, more people tend to buy shares in funds that perform better, and fewer people tend to buy shares in funds that perform worse. Whoa! Isn't that astonishing?
It's amazing.
And if you capital weight mutual funds, by the way, in other words, if you say, okay, let's give a larger weight, just like the S&P 500 is capital weighted, we'll give a larger piece of the percentage of the average to a fund that has more money in it. Then mutual funds run off and leave the indexes in a cloud of dust. But the other thing, and it's mentioned in this column, if you were an investor and you invested your money along the way over the last 30 years, you probably didn't have a lump sum that you threw in 30 years ago, but you put in money steadily along the way, you would not have gotten an 11.1% return. Because all of your money was not in the S&P 500 from day one, so there's a lot of complexity when an index is used as a benchmark. There's a lot of complexity and confusion when somebody tries to compare a mutual fund to the S&P 500, looking at straight performance. You know, and there's so much more to it than that, and we're off on a subject like mad, but we do need to play some commercials.
Yes, we do.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back after these words from KTEM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Some other data that came out today in a place that we don't usually quote, but I think is pretty important. The UK just came out with its GDP growth numbers, and they are just a little bit below the numbers of before the recession, which is a big deal. It means that they are moving forward at the same rate that they were moving forward before they fell down. But this means that the recovery is almost over for the UK. They're almost back to the same growth rates that they were before the recession. That's not true across Europe. It is true in big chunks of Northern Europe. And what that means is that if we're looking at the rest of the world, if we're talking about emerging markets, whether that's Thailand or China or, unfortunately, Russia, although Russia is going to have one of those other extenuating circumstances limiting its growth rate, unless you're talking about physical growth. If it's geological growth, geographical growth, its growth rate is going faster than the United States. We haven't added any new states recently. But if we're looking about the rest of the emerging market world, Brazil, the places that have been hit hard lately have been hit hard because the industrialized nations are not buying from them. Well, now that our economy is well into recovery and Northern Europe is well into recovery, the emerging markets will be following. And I realize right now a lot of people are looking at that and saying these markets are in bad shape. We've got, you know, the demand is down and things just aren't the way they used to be. Well, when people say things aren't the way they used to be, that it's different this time, I always have a red flag that comes up that says, wait a minute. People are people no matter how small. No, that's Horton Hears a Who. People are people no matter when it is. We act the same way. And when our economies are in full swing, we buy from the cheapest places, and the cheapest places happen to be the emerging markets. So right now, there's a lag. Our economies are recovered. They're moving forward. And I realize a lot of people say, well, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Our economy's recovered.
Yeah, our economy is recovered, but the jobs, the number of people with jobs hasn't.
Correct. We have more people employed today than we did before the recession, but there's more people in the workforce than there were before the recession. This is where economics gets a little bit weird. If you, it's kind of like adding inflation into things. In this case, it's inflated workforce. We're still not as fully employed by any stretch as we were before the recession. So the economy itself, the size of the economy is bigger than what it was. Mm-hmm.
Which means our productivity has gone up. Now, you may have heard recently that productivity dropped.
Yes.
In the first quarter. It did. And that's because if a person is getting paid, they're on a salary, and they can't get to work because there was a blizzard.
You're right. They make less things.
That is lowered productivity.
Yeah. That you can we measure productivity by saying how many widgets are made, and widgets are these magical things that I've never been able to find one.
Right.
I've tried calling widget stores. They don't exist. Anyway, when people are making widgets and they can make more widgets by themselves than they could make a year ago, then the productivity's gone up. But if there's a blizzard, it means that you build less widgets.
And if you ever find a widget, you'll find the widget is made by Economic Man.
Economic Man?
Yeah, it's Homo Economus.
Homo Economus. He and his 0.3 daughters.
You have 0.3 daughters?
I believe by Homo Sensicus. And has point, yes.
I think. Oh, okay. I've never seen a point three daughter. Have, either. They have 1.01 dogs.
And according to statistics, in the United
he
States,
and his, he and the funny thing is, there is no economic woman.
Well, there is a census woman,
but there's no economic woman. There's an economic man in economics, but there is no economic woman. But they have, but apparently two. Apparently, Economic Man can be married.
Right.
And can have children.
Right. But without Economic Woman,
We're trying to figure out. Only economists could come up with that.
Right. Well, here's the census side of things. Says somewhere in the United States, every 10 minutes, a woman has a baby. A woman gives birth. Somebody stop that woman.
Why?
I mean, that's not healthy. Every 10 minutes is she's a little too fast.
She's an exceptional woman.
That's the problem with statistics. It's we get the tenses wrong. We get the pluralities wrong.
Yeah. But in the United States, a couple of things have happened. Housing starts are, and the housing market in general stinks. And as I said to somebody this week in the office, I don't remember who it was, but I was talking to him about it. The problem with the housing market in the United States, the problem with house building, which really needs to get rolling again if we're going to get
those are called motorhomes. Motorhomes are rolling houses.
Right. Well, actually, the things they use to make houses are carried around on trucks. So
that's true. That is rolling houses.
Yes,
okay.
We need to get the house construction rolling here. The reason it is so low, and it is worrisome. That's what Janet Yellen said.
Correct.
Is because interest rates are too low.
Yep.
You already got this?
Yeah.
You're pretty smart.
You would think it would be the opposite. If interest rates are low, then you should have a lot of building going on, unless you're a bank.
Right. but the whole point is that if you are in the position of loaning money, and I realize it's not just a bank, but you're in the position of loaning money to somebody to buy a house, and you look at the interest rate on mortgages, which is just over 3%.
It's not very good.
And you realize that long-term inflation in the United States averages about 3%.
If you're going to give a 30-year mortgage to somebody that's going to average what inflation does?
And if interest rates were to go down, they could dump your loan and get a new one.
Right.
But if they go up,
they're going to hold on to it.
They're going to hold on to it. So basically, banks and mortgage lending institutions are in the awkward position of probably gonna lose money over the long term on any mortgage loan they make today. And as a result, they are very picky about to whom they will loan money for a house. And they insist on large down payments. In other words, they're not willing to take any risk at all.
Because there's no reward in it.
Because there's no reward in it. Now, you get interest rates back up to where they historically would be normal, which is 5, 6%.
Then it's profitable to make loans on houses
then,
again.
Then banks will start being willing to loan money, even in what they call spec houses, where the builder is going to build a house and then sell it.
Right.
Which you don't see happening anymore. And at that point, basically, we need interest rates to come up, and there's a big argument, by the way, among some that some economists have made, and I'm not taking a side on it, that the reason our recovery has been so slow is because of quantitative easing.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt in my mind about that. There are two things that have happened here that have been amazingly good for our recovery and also amazingly bad for our recovery. Quantitative easing is one of them, and you're talking about that, because interest rates being as low as they are have allowed people to get short-term loans with very little risk to get them out of little bits of difficulty. It has allowed the movement of money around that was frozen up. And the Federal Reserve was pumping money into the economy and buying up bonds, and these bonds were going somewhere. Okay, so that's a good thing. But it also means that the banks aren't going to loan money out because they're not going to make a profit on it over a long period of time. The other great thing to keep us from being in a depression but is not really good for the overall long-term recovery was unemployment. Unemployment over a long period of time, when you pay people for not working,
you're talking about not the actual fact of unemployment.
No,
but unemployment compensation.
Correct, where the government is paying people for being unemployed.
It was actually good for the economy.
It was really, really good to keep it from going into a depression.
Right.
But it's really, really bad for the recovery.
It's like Social Security.
Right. It is a safety net, but it doesn't have a ladder attached to it. To get off the net is really hard.
If I could draw an analogy that I thought of when I was reading this.
Besides a safety net with a ladder on it? Because I thought you could just imagine a tripod or bipod type ladder on a safety net. No. Okay, you've got a better analogy. Go ahead.
When you have something go really bad wrong with your body and the doctors have to work on you and they have to do things, they have to cut you and hurt you and they have to put blood in you and things like that.
Right.
They put you in bed.
Yep.
And that's good when you're really, really sick.
Keeps you from dying.
But every study has shown, within certain limitations, the quicker you get the person out of bed and back on their feet,
the better they recover.
The quicker they recover.
Right.
And I strongly suspect that our economy is in the position right now where, we applied pretty much the correct things to do to the because of the trauma that hit the economy financially.
Better than we ever have, ever, in the past.
Right. But I think our backing off from that and getting the economy back walking on its own has been a little bit slow.
Yeah. What's happened is the patient is getting ready to get up, stumbles a little bit and goes, oh, that's hard. Oh, that's hard. The Federal Reserve goes, lie down. We got this. We got it. You're okay. Don't fall down.
And this is, by the way, why I was very happy to hear Janet Yellen, when she testified, actually read it, I didn't hear it, when she testified before Congress last week and in previous announcements clearly state that the tapering, the reduction in quantitative easing, the getting the patient out of bed,
as I like to call it, the easing of the easing,
as is going to progress steadily, despite the fact that we'll probably get a revision to say that we had a negative GDP growth.
Correct.
In the first quarter.
Yeah, I have to give you a compliment, sir. So
that's scary.
Yes, it's a compliment. Your analogy was far better than my analogy. Although I like the idea of a folding ladder on a net under a trapeze as a concept, it's not something you see on day-to-day life very often.
The folding ladder on the net is scary because you could drop and hit the folding ladder.
But getting out of a hospital bed, that actually makes sense. My analogy in this case was ludicrous. And while I like ludocracy.
You do indeed.
The hospital room metaphor analogy was much better.
Another piece of good news out there. I know that people don't like it when we have a lot of good news, but the new foreclosures have fallen to the lowest level since 2006.
That's pre-recession.
And we are getting down towards, we're not there yet, by the way, but we're getting down towards a normal level of overdue mortgage payments and foreclosures. The historic norm in the United States has been about 4%, about 4% of loans, home mortgages over the last 20 or 30 years, with the exception of course, the Great Recession we just saw, go into foreclosure. So basically, if you say 4 or 5%, the argument was basically when a loan was made, the bank made an assumption, and bank is a generic term here, that 1 in 20 loans are going to fail.
A little less than 1 in 20.
So, say 5%, okay?
Right. So you got to charge the interest.
They process that into the system. We're currently running about, in the foreclosure process right now, we have about 8% of the loans in the United States are in the foreclosure process.
Right.
But when you set those aside, only about 5.5% of loans are 30 days or more overdue right now.
Right.
So that is obviously it gets 30 or more days overdue before it goes into the foreclosure process.
Right.
And this is from a peak back in late 2009. We had 14% of the mortgages in the United States in the foreclosure process and another 10% that were in that were over 30 days overdue. So we actually had 24% of the mortgages in the United States in a distress situation, and now we're down to about 14.
Yeah. This is fascinating, really fascinating to me. Most people go, yeah, right, Jake, that's not so fascinating. Most people did not know anyone that had a foreclosure. But 14% of the mortgages were in foreclosure. Now, not all 14% were foreclosed on, which is a big thing here, so we have to say that. But a big chunk of those were. And the reason why most people don't know anyone that had a foreclosure on, well, one, most people that listen to us are in Texas, and we didn't have anywhere near that foreclosure rate. But even so, if you go to Florida, where there was this big foreclosure rate, or Nevada, most people didn't know somebody that had a foreclosure. And I know that sounds weird because there were a lot of foreclosures done. And that's because the people that were in distress, the people that were in foreclosure, those loans were generally more than one loan per person. It was concentrated. Sometimes it was three and four loans in foreclosure for the same person.
Right.
So when you look at the percentage of loans out there, towards the end there, in 2007 and 2008, a lot of loans were being taken by the same people. They were taking a lot of loans at the same time, and those were the ones that didn't work. And it's, you know, when you hear somebody that's, just think back to the 2006 time period where the late night television people were talking about, use other people's money. You can get rich overnight. And what you do is you get a lot of mortgages on a lot of different houses. You get 16 houses and you can work from home and you'll get rent on all of these. You can flip these houses and you can make money. That's a big chunk of the problem right there.
Let me tell you something about the foreclosure process that you may already know. I don't know. The average loan that's in the foreclosure process, I've got it right here, has not made the mortgage owner payer has not made a payment in more than 2 years. And on average, a loan that completed foreclosure in March had been delinquent for 955 days. That's almost 3 years.
Yeah. So when you're talking about somebody that's more than 30 days past due, they've missed a month or they've missed 2 months. That's not such that
right.
The banks don't want to foreclose on that. They want to get you back and ready to go. If you've missed 3 years of payments, they want the house back.
Yeah. And the other thing that another piece of good news is that in 2009, one third of all houses in the United States were, as they say in the financial business, underwater. Which sounds terrible. It is. It just meant that the mortgage balance was larger than the appraised value of the house.
I was thinking about selling boat houses at that point.
Underwater.
You know, yeah.
No, but they're actually set on top of the water.
Yeah, they're not underwater at all.
Yeah,
but you know,
be submersibles. Now we're down to 1 in 10,
which is a much better number.
So of the homes in the United States, only 10%. Have a mortgage larger than the appraised value of the house. So we are making some very good progress. It is very slow compared with what we've seen historically. By the way,
and the slowness has to do with how well we've treated it.
But also coming out of a financial crisis historically is very, very different from coming out of what's called a business cycle recession.
Yeah.
It takes years. And we are taking years to dig out, and there's a lot.
Yeah, and this is something we can talk about more next hour about. Most recessions are started by consumer spending or lack thereof. And this particular case, it happened to be businesses that caused it, and it had to do with the banks not giving loans and so on. That's a much more serious recession, which is why we tend to call this one the Great Recession. Because when the businesses lead the recession, they're the ones that hire. When they're hurt, the consumers have to stop spending eventually.
We're about out of time, but I want to remind me at the beginning of the next hour, I want to talk about the number of job openings in the United States. I looked that
Sounds
up.
Sounds great.
And I was really astonished.
Yeah. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach that voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can also go to our webpage, which is tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.